Jackie had agreed to head up Sam's software development team for the 8 months Sam estimated it would take to move the latest version of their software from concept to reality. Sam and his competitors run neck and neck in their attempts to introduce the newest, slickest versions of their products to the marketplace. And Sam felt, with Jackie heading up the team, we'll hit our target delivery date. Getting Jackie is a real coup. She had lots of options, including working with one of our competitors. But she chose us, and she starts tomorrow. This is too good to be true. A mere 30 days later, Sam groaned when I asked, "What is the most important thing you and I should be talking about today?" "If you ever hear me say that something is too good to be true, kick me," he said. "What's happened?" I asked. About a week after Jackie came on board, John, a member of the software development team, and I pulled into the parking lot at the same time, so I asked him how things were going. He said things were a little tense. I asked him what he meant, and he told me that the day before, he had been in Jackie's office asking her questions, and she had said, "I don't have time for private tutoring sessions. Work this out on your own time." John told me this seems to be typical of how Jackie deals with people. Of course, Sam said, I was sure they'd get through this. After all, they're all adults, professionals in their fields. I assumed this was just a bump in the road. Sam sighed deeply. I prompted, "More like a landmine?" "Oh, yeah." A week later, Sarah passed me in the hall and said, "Guess you heard about the meeting." "What meeting?" I asked. She told me that the software team had met, and at one point they were all stumped. Seems there's a glitch in the software and nobody knows how to resolve it. So they were just sitting there looking at a diagram Jackie had drawn on the flip chart when suddenly Jackie ripped the page off the flip chart, crumbled it up, and pitched it over her shoulder. She said, "I thought you guys were better than this. This team is not what I signed up for." And she walked out the door, left them all sitting there. "Yikes," I uttered. "And you know what really frustrates me?" Sam said. "I still didn't do anything. I hate conflict, so I clung to the fantasy that somehow this would all go away and they'd play nice." "And the coup de grace?" I asked. "Delivered this morning by Peter." Peter is Sam's first employee and the single individual besides Sam who most influences the culture of the company. Sam said, "This morning Peter came into my office, closed the door, and said that something had happened that I needed to know about. Peter admitted that he gets calls from headhunters from time to time, but that he never takes those calls, never listens to the pitch. He told me that yesterday he got a call, and this time he listened. He scheduled a meeting with a recruiter." The look on my face mirrored Sam's. Sam continued, "He told me that he had just canceled the meeting and that he doesn't want to leave. Of course, I asked him what was going on, and he said, 'The thought of working with Jackie for another 7 months is not a good one. She's brilliant, no question, but she's got some seriously sharp edges, and people are getting hurt. I doubt I'm the only person wondering if I can endure the next 7 months.'" Sam sighed. "I've got to talk to her. Today." Before we discuss the model Sam and I used to prepare him for his talk with Jackie, imagine you are Sam. Let's assume you don't want to fire Jackie, at least not yet. Ideally, you'd like to save the relationship. What might you say or ask to open the conversation with her? Take a moment to think about this. In a confrontation, the first 60 seconds are key. If you don't prepare your opening statement, but instead dive in holding out hope that this time it will be different, you will probably make one of a number of common errors in confronting behavior. It seems we're so uncomfortable with the whole notion of confrontation that we either make the mistake of building up a head of steam, then burst through the door, hurl our words across the table, and bolt, or we soften our message to the point that the other person leaves the conversation thinking we've just had a lovely chat. When we hurl and bolt, we damage the relationship. When we soften and protect, the message is lost, and it's unlikely anything will change. Delivering a difficult message clearly, cleanly, and succinctly is essential. In organizations where leaders have developed the courage and skills required to stay current and to communicate honestly with coworkers regarding behavior issues, there is far less stress and considerably fewer concerns about lawsuits. If you need to confront someone's behavior, do not begin by asking that person how things are going or by complimenting him or her. Don't surround your message with pillows. Come straight at the issue, get right to the point. Say what you have to say in 60 seconds, then immediately extend an invitation to your partner to join the conversation. You're probably thinking, 60 seconds? That's not enough time to express all the angst that's been building up inside me. Not nearly enough time to unleash the emotional diatribe I've rehearsed in my mind. But oh, how powerful. When your opening statement has been prepared and delivered with skill and grace, the invitation to your partner to participate wholeheartedly and thoughtfully in the conversation will be compelling. It's highly likely that the relationship will be enriched in the process. Remember, enriching relationships is one of the purposes of a fierce conversation. Here's the model I use when I need to confront someone's behavior or coach someone else to do so. It's the model I use to prepare Sam for his conversation with Jackie. This model was inspired in part by Craig Weber, president of the Weber Consulting Group, who suggests that if you wish to craft conversations that moderate our worst conversational tendencies, you should advocate your position clearly and succinctly. Illustrate your position by sharing the thinking behind it. Publicly test your views and invite and encourage others to do so as well. Inquire into the views of others and actively explore their thinking. I concur with Craig and have broken down potentially challenging conversations into three distinct parts: opening statement, interaction, and resolution. Let's look at the all-important opening statement phase of a confrontation. Later, I will tell you what happened during Sam's interaction and resolution with Jackie and what happened after that. Preparation of your opening statement is essential. Do your homework. Write down your opening statement and practice saying it out loud. If you just rehearse it in your head, when the curtain goes up, you may be appalled at the words that actually come out of your mouth. There are 7 components to an opening statement. Number 1, name the issue. Name the behavior that is causing the problem and the area the behavior is impacting. Number 2, select a specific example that illustrates the behavior or situation you want to change. Since you've only got 60 seconds in which to make your entire opening statement, this example must be succinct. No long stories. Number 3. Describe your emotions about this issue. Emotions are deeply personal, and you're letting the person know that you are affected. Number 4. Clarify what is at stake. In other words, why is this important? Use the words "at stake." Those words have an emotional impact. Number 5. Identify your contribution to this problem. No long confession is needed here. What is appropriate is a brief acknowledgement that you recognize any role you may have played in creating the problem and that you intend to do something about it. Number 6. Indicate your wish to resolve the issue. Use the word resolve. It shows that there's no firing squad waiting outside the door. To say, "This is what I want to resolve," communicates good intent on your part. Finally, number 7, invite your partner to respond. The invitation is offered to join the conversation, and the conversation has barely begun. You can say, for example, "I want to understand what is happening from your perspective. Please talk to me about what's going on with you and the team." I imagine some of you are thinking, this all sounds well and good, but you don't know the person I need to confront. There's a serious issue I need to discuss with him, but I can tell you right now, he won't play fair or nice. How do I influence such a person to come out from behind himself into the conversation and make it real? Ask him to. Ask her to. And make your part of it real. That's all you can do. Remember, all conversations are with myself, and sometimes they involve other people. This idea can be tough to come to terms with, yet it is essential that you grapple with it. Otherwise, while you may understand the importance of conversations, you may find yourself holding back, not having them, because of one of the most common concerns I hear in my workshops. The most popular reason for not engaging a particular individual in a conversation is they can't handle it. Other familiar versions go something like, they'll get defensive, they'll be hurt, they won't talk about it, they'll get emotional, irrational, angry, illogical, and sotto voce, they'll get even. Countless corporate teams and families are held hostage by a single dysfunctional human being who has got the entire tribe cowed into avoiding the topics that need addressing. They've taught us, if you dare bring up this issue or talk to me about things I'd rather not face, you'll be sorry. It won't be pretty. Even though we recognize that we've got to address this issue, we still hear ourselves saying, they can't handle it. They aren't ready. It is critical to recognize that we ourselves can't handle it, aren't ready, lack the courage. Fierce conversations cannot be dependent on how others respond. If your life succeeds or fails one conversation at a time, and if the conversation is the relationship, ensuring that these conversations take place is up to you. In other words, if you know something must change, then know that it is you who must change it. Your job is to extend the invitation. What if the invitation is declined? Extend it again and again. My experience is that when the invitation is extended with grace and skill, it will be accepted, even by those you've almost given up on. We can have the conversations needed to create the results we say we want in our lives, or we can have all of our reasons why we can't have those conversations. But we can't have both. Reasons or results, we get to choose. Which would you rather have? Staying current regarding issues that are troubling or perplexing us enriches and simplifies our relationships. Neither of us has to try to figure out what the other person really thinks and feels, an altogether exhausting and futile endeavor anyway. Sam's opening statement took about 45 minutes to prepare and practice. It covered all the bases, avoided common errors, and took about 60 seconds to say. When you put all the pieces together, Sam's opening statement went like this. Jackie, I want to talk with you about the effect your leadership style is having on the team. I learned that when John asked you questions, you told him you didn't have time for private tutoring sessions. I learned that during a meeting with the team, you wadded up a page from the flip chart, threw it on the floor, said that this wasn't the team you had signed up for, and left the room. I am deeply concerned, and I'm fearful of the possible consequences. There's a great deal at stake. A long-term employee has considered leaving the company rather than work with you. I'm not prepared to lose good people who I hope will be here long after this project is completed and you've gone on to your next assignment. Meeting our deadline is essential. Our reputation as a product leader is on the line, as well as our professional pride, pleasing our customers, and considerable financial gain. Perhaps there's little or nothing at stake for you, Jackie. If it doesn't work out and you leave us, you can undoubtedly get another job quickly. But for us, the stakes are high. My role in creating a growing rift between you and others is that I did not bring this to your attention earlier. This is what I want to resolve with you, Jackie. The effect your leadership style is having on the team. I want to understand what's happening from your perspective. Please talk to me about what's going on with you and the team. Let's return to the confrontation model and then learn what happened following Sam's opening statement. The next step after the opening statement is the interaction, where you inquire into your partner's views. Though there is only one step in the interaction part of a confrontation, it is here that the bulk of the conversation takes place. You have extended an invitation to your partner, and now you are listening. This is where reality will most certainly be interrogated. If your partner says something with which you violently disagree, resist the temptation to build a stronger case. Simply listen, so that your own learning may be provoked. Ask questions. Dig for full understanding. Use paraphrasing and perception checks. Don't be satisfied with what's on the surface. For example, you can say, "Please say more about this. I see it quite differently, so I'd like to understand your thinking, how you came to this conclusion." Or, "May I tell you what I'm hearing? I want to make sure I've understood you." We are often severely tested during the interaction phase. It is not easy to contain our emotions during an interaction with someone whose comments or behavior makes you want to leap over the desk or coffee table and strangle him or her. When we struggle to wrap our minds around a partner's alternative reality, it's helpful to recall that in all conversations, including confrontations, each of us is interpreting what is said through our own highly individualized filters. Rather than jump back in and start talking as soon as your partner says something you feel is off base, focus on examining your partner's reality and his or her filters. It may help to give yourself the secret rule of mineral rights, questions only. Finally, when your partner knows that you fully understand and acknowledge his or her view of reality, move toward resolution, which includes an agreement about what is to happen next. After all, you said your intent was to resolve the issue, and here are some questions that will help you accomplish this. You can ask, "What have we learned? Where are we now? Has anything been left unsaid that needs saying? What is needed for resolution? How can we move forward from here given our new understanding?" You can end the conversation by making an agreement and determining how you will hold each other responsible for keeping it. Though I was not present during Sam's conversation with Jackie, from his later account, it's clear that Sam did a number of things really well. As soon as Sam extended the invitation to Jackie to offer her perspective, she responded, "If people were upset, it would have been nice if they'd come to me." Sam was prepared for such an attempt at deflection, and he replied, "We're here to talk about the effect your leadership style is having on the team, Jackie. What's going on from where you sit?" During the interaction part of the confrontation, Sam gave himself the rule to make no declarative statements until he couldn't stand it anymore, and then for a while longer, he pitched his tent on questions. Eventually, two things happened. Jackie figured out that she was not going to be shot at dawn, at least not immediately. She also saw that there was no place to hide. Sam could not be seduced onto rabbit trails. Whenever Jackie headed off into the bushes, Sam brought her back. Sometimes he just quietly said, "Return to the topic, Jackie," and she came back. In the course of their conversation, Jackie settled down and became thoughtful, less defensive, and Sam learned what his contribution to the problem had been. There was indeed a glitch in the software that no one, including Jackie, knew how to resolve. No one on the team had any experience with this particular problem. Jackie's concern was palpable. She had a reputation for never missing a deadline, and now she had a critical problem that no one knew how to resolve. Naturally, she feared this project might tarnish her reputation. Most of us have heard the phrase, "Where there is anger, there is fear." Not that it made everything okay, but Sam began to understand the edge to most of Jackie's comments. In moving toward resolution, Sam acknowledged, I misdiagnosed the capabilities of the team. I thought we had all the talent needed on this project, and clearly we don't. Do you know anyone who has the experience we need? Yes, she responded. I know exactly the person. I don't know if he's available, but he could help. Well, Sam said, it blows the budget, but I'm willing to put the money in to get someone on board. Will you call and find out if he's available? Yes, of course, she answered. Now, Sam said, tell me what you are willing to do, Jackie. Perhaps because their interaction had been productive and even pleasant, Jackie attempted to minimize her role in the problem. Oh, we'll be fine, she said. I'm sure the team will get used to me. It was at this point that Sam's particular genius was revealed. I share this with you because there is a great lesson here. Sam sat quietly for a moment, then said, that isn't adequate, Jackie. There must be some changes on your part. Tell me something. Have you ever received feedback like this anywhere else in your life? Jackie sat back in her chair. Her face reddened and she looked away. At last she murmured, as a matter of fact, yes, I have. Sam waited a moment, then continued, Jackie, you don't have to change your leadership style. You don't have to change, period. Nobody does. You'll need to make some changes to stay here. But if you aren't willing to do that, you can leave, get another assignment, and get on with your life. And possibly get the same feedback down the road. If that's your decision, then so be it. I'll have another problem to solve, but I'll solve it. On the other hand, you could decide that this is as good a time and place as any to take yourself on. Because that's what we're talking about, taking yourself on. Going inside with clippers and a soldering iron and doing some internal rewiring. That's a lot to ask of anyone, and you may not be willing or able to do that right now. I see this as an important choice point for you, Jackie. So I'd like to meet with you at 8 tomorrow morning and learn your decision. If you are willing to make some alterations in your leadership style, I'll help you, coach you. If you aren't, we'll part company, no hard feelings. The next morning, Jackie looked like something the cat had dragged in. She'd clearly had a bad night, but she said, I made the call to the person I told you about and he's available. He's coming on board the day after tomorrow. And Sam, I'd like to stay. I don't know how it will go, but I'd like to make it work. It's an exciting project and the people on the team are good. And I sense this is where I need to be, for lots of reasons. That's wonderful, Jackie, Sam said. I'm really glad. Okay, let's get to work. What's your next meeting? Who's it with and what is the purpose? Thus Sam began coaching Jackie. He didn't attempt to change her essential nature. He just took it step by step, asking a lot of questions. The first was, what's the next thing you need to do? Jackie grimaced and said, this is the part where you're going to suggest that I apologize to John and the others on the team. I hate this. I'm lousy at apologies. They both laughed. 7 months later, right on schedule, Jackie and the team rolled out a product that blew the competition out of the water. Following the big splash, there was a going-away party for Jackie, during which appreciation and congratulations were extended. I learned a lot from you. It's been great working together. The team said these things. Jackie said these things. All were sincere. Before leaving, Jackie pulled Sam into his office. When they returned, Sam pulled me aside and told me what had happened. His eyes were shining. Sam, Jackie had said, there's something I want to tell you. She was clearly struggling with her emotions. You know that conversation we had a while ago? You know the one I mean? Yes, I think I do, Sam replied. Well, that conversation. Jackie looked at Sam and her eyes filled with tears. That conversation saved my marriage. So, I owe you, Sam, big time. If you ever need me, please call me and I'll find a way to get here. That's a promise. Sam and Jackie have since worked together on another project. It's been wonderful to see the pleasure they take in their professional relationship. and it has been a privilege to see a talented woman add compassion and considerable grace to her brilliance. What was Sam's genius? Recognizing that when someone has a behavior at work that is causing a problem, it is inevitably showing up elsewhere in his or her life, causing similar problems. What we do at work that hurts people or alienates coworkers, we also do at home, hurting and alienating those we love. Likewise, our behavior at home shows up in the workplace. When we confront behavior with courage and skill, we are offering a gift. And of course it goes both ways. While it may be difficult to hear others' truths about ourselves, there is likely a vein of gold worth mining. Think about the fierce conversations you've already identified that you need to have. Your first step is to write down the dates by which you will have had these conversations. Now, choose one of these conversations and prepare your 7-step opening statement by writing down exactly what you will say. Once you're satisfied with a final draft, practice your opening statement until you own the words, until the words come out straight, clean, and clear, until you know and own the ground on which you stand. Have the conversation with a person you wish to address by the date you indicated. With courage and practice, your discomfort in confronting difficult but important issues will lessen over time. The goal is for you to become and remain current with the important people in your life. No more recycled tears, no recurring anger.
Principle 5. Obey your instincts.
There is a point where fact-finding and research accomplish nothing. Sometimes we just have to ask ourselves, is it right or wrong, yes or no, right or left, and we know. A business person takes a deep breath and commits funds to a vision. Lovers let go of the past and commit to the present, or recognize that they are fundamentally wrong for each other and say goodbye. Our radar works perfectly. It's the operator who is in question. Things don't always make sense. They just are. There are things our gut knows long before our intellect catches on. Every day, all day, an intelligent agent is sending us messages. We hear them in our heads, feel them in our guts, discern them in our hearts. They come to us while we're sleeping. Albert Einstein had his best ideas in the morning while shaving. Do not trust your instincts. Obey them. Obeying your instincts requires that you listen to your own internal voice. Acknowledge your internal reference point rather than rush to embrace the myriad references and voices of others. Most of us allow ourselves to be influenced or persuaded that the voice within us is mistaken, flawed, at best a distraction. And if we are intent on gaining others' approval, we are quick to discard our insights, commanding the voice inside us, "Shut up and go to your room." In fierce conversations, there is neither a struggle for approval nor an attempt to persuade. There is, instead, an interchange of ideas and sentiments during which you pay attention to and disclose your inner thoughts while actively inviting others to do the same. Our thoughts, wonderings, unexplained memories, and yes, suspicions, speak to our oldest neurons and synapses. We know things. We sense things. We don't know how or why we know things. We just do. For example, as you are listening now, I encourage you to pay attention to the connections you're making in your mind between what I'm suggesting and your own life. Go beyond the words I'm saying and pay attention to what you're thinking and feeling as you hear them. This is what I want to teach you to do in your conversations. Practice becoming intuitively aware of the thoughts and feelings of the most important people in your life. You will learn to obey your instincts while inviting others with differing views to challenge your thinking. You will continually check in with your inner reference point and disclose what you find there, with no concerns about approval or control, either yours or that of others. How we enter our conversations is how we emerge from them. Holding back, not paying attention, disengaged, half asleep, or available, present, engaged, awake. If we're to be the latter, as you learned earlier, we need to listen for more than content. We need to listen for emotion and intent as well. In Crossing the Unknown Sea, David White writes, "In the surface conversation of our colleague, we listen for the undercurrent, the persistent tug and ebb that tells us she is actually going in the opposite direction to her speech." Take a moment and think back to your conversations during the last 30 days. Imagine yourself sitting with your coworkers, with your boss, with your customers, with your lover, with your child, with your friend. As you listened to each individual, what did you think but not say? What were your thoughts about these thoughts? What did you do with those thoughts? Did you think, "I need to say something here, but I don't know what it is"? Or did you know you needed to say something yet acted inconsistently with that impulse? In the interest of fierce conversations, what is really needed here is a reality check of some kind, a conversation about your conversation. Remember, the conversation is the relationship. How is it possible to have a conversation about a conversation? We can do it only if we first carry on a private internal conversation. This is how we find out what we are thinking. But how do we find out what we are thinking? This sounds obvious, but it isn't. Sometimes we don't know what we think until we hear ourselves say it aloud. Sometimes we believe that our internal conversation is in the way of our being present, so we try to push it away. Being 100% present means being present for everything that is occurring in the moment. It's like a split-screen TV. On the left side are your private thoughts. On the right, your public thoughts. When your left side thinks, "You're crazy, we can't do that," your right side says, "Sure, no problem." We filter our private conversations, making public only what we assume will be heard, will not upset people, will get us what we want, and so forth. When we keep important thoughts private, our ability to learn and to make good decisions is reduced. But if we say what we think, we are afraid it will make things worse by upsetting people or making ourselves vulnerable. Our dilemma is keep it private and prevent ourselves and others from learning, or say it, knowing that we might upset someone or make ourselves vulnerable. Yet, unconsciously, most people are asking us to visit the edge or frontier with them. To go there, we may need to change how we think in the first place. What if we drilled down, hit oil, decided what's the rich part and what's junk, refined it, and used it? To do this, we need to value our instincts as a resource. In addition to paying attention to the person, we must also pay attention to and value the messages we're receiving from ourselves. This approach, developed by Chris Argyris and Donald Schoen, was first presented in their book, Theory in Practice. It has come to be known as the left-hand column. Essentially, you can think of your brain as split into left-hand, middle, and right-hand columns. In the left-hand column are your private thoughts, what you think and feel but don't say. The middle column is the neutral zone, where you are aware of what you think and feel without attachment. In the right column are your public thoughts, what you see and hear, what is shared and known. There was a time in my life when I considered my left-hand column to be a royal pain, all those distracting private thoughts, all those crazy notions that derailed the conversation, thoughts such as, "Why is she talking about this? This isn't the real issue," or, "He says everything is fine. I don't think he believes that." Years ago, I read about Dr. Carl Simonton, whose clinic in California had an amazing cure rate for supposedly incurable cancer victims. He encouraged his patients to listen carefully to their personal insights about what they needed to do. Most important, he urged his patients to take action on those insights as soon as it was humanly possible. He said something like, "Those messages are from you to you. They are from the part of you that knows what is needed to help you get better. If you ignore those messages, eventually you'll stop getting them. The part of you that offers insights will say, 'No use telling her, she doesn't listen.'" This got my attention, and I resolved to get better at putting my instincts to work as the powerful tools that they are. I began to meditate, starting my day with a brief quiet time, which ends with the question, "Is there a message?" A message often presents itself. I remember a time when I faced a difficult decision. It involved leaving a particular corporate client whose president had an ongoing integrity outage that he refused to correct. Not surprisingly, he encountered the same problems over and over, yet insisted on pointing the finger elsewhere. In addition, I wondered if he had attention deficit disorder. His son had been diagnosed with this challenge, and I was aware that it was inherited. He declined to investigate this possibility, even as our conversations raced from one incomplete thought or issue to the next, with no resolution, no clarity. Our conversations were maddeningly unfocused and confusing. I became keenly aware that despite my best efforts at helping him frame a topic for discussion and remain at least for a while within the boundaries of one topic at a time, our work together was unsuccessful and deeply frustrating. The voices inside my head urged, "You are not the right person to help this individual. You're only a phase on the way to someplace more useful for him. Get out of the way so someone else can step in." I realized that it was I who had an integrity outage. My emotional fatigue was understandable. I had not been present with or attentive to myself. One part of me was urging me to cease my work with this client, and the other part of me was countering, "Yes, but..." In disregarding my instincts, I essentially had been telling myself that I didn't exist 50% of the time. I met with my client that day and told him what I'd been feeling. I spoke of the integrity outage that I could no longer look past, and also of my concern that he might have attention deficit disorder, which contributed to his inability to communicate effectively. I told him that, based on results, I wasn't the right resource for him and that I felt we should stop working together. He said, "I've been expecting this. I've been thinking about some of the things you've said. Maybe I do need to get tested for ADD. I noted that he didn't say anything about correcting the integrity outage, so I thanked him for having allowed me into his confidence, pointed him toward the resources we both felt could be useful, shook his hand, and left, feeling energized, grounded, and determined to pay fierce attention to that ongoing conversation we all have with ourselves. And what of our conversations with others? We all have many thoughts as we listen to friends, colleagues, kids, spouses, customers. For some time now, as I have practiced Principle 3, be here, prepared to be nowhere else, I have attempted to capture and share elusive thoughts and emotions. During a fierce conversation, my role is not to say what is easy to say or what we all can say, but to say what we have been unable to say. I try to pay attention to things that may pass unobserved by others and bring them out into the open. The most valuable thing any of us can do is find a way to say the things that can't be said. The left-hand column will assist you in this process. You will pull your thoughts from the dim corners where they would prefer to hide. You will bring them into the light, catch them in mid-flight. This is how it's done. Listen to both sides of your brain as if you were hearing two conversations at the same time. One conversation is the literal conversation that is visible, audible. The other conversation is the one going on inside your head, what you are thinking and feeling. Bring some of your private thoughts and feelings into the neutral zone by noticing them without attachment. They aren't right or wrong, they just exist. Become interested in them as phenomena in the world, as if they were interesting shells you found on the beach. When you are ready, you can bring these thoughts into the public conversation. If you like, you can use these words. While you were speaking, I had a thought that I would like to check out with you. This is called perception checking. It lets your partner in on what you've been thinking and feeling, but it doesn't invite defensiveness because you didn't interject your thoughts as the capital T truth. Another approach is to ask a question to open up a willingness on another person's part. For example, you might ask, "Would you like to hear something I'm feeling right now?" Then, assuming your partner is willing and interested, share your thought. It takes a certain fearlessness to make your private thoughts public. But if what you're thinking makes you squirm and wish to wriggle away, you're probably onto something. You may ask, can our instincts get us in trouble? After all, our instincts are not always correct. There have certainly been times when I managed to possess an incorrect but fervent understanding of an issue. And sometimes I found myself just plain lost. I have no idea what a conversation is even pretending to be about. At times like that, I have sometimes said, "I'm as confused as you appear to be. How do we dig out of here?" It's not our thoughts or feelings that get us into trouble. It's not our disclosures that cause distress. It's our attachment to them, our belief that we are right. I want to emphasize the importance of releasing any attachment to our thoughts and interpretations as the truth. Few people appreciate being told what you really mean is, followed by a motive or meaning that could not be further from the truth. That would feel like a violation, like trying to play tennis with someone who refused to stay on his or her side of the net. The left-hand column is about how to stay on your side of the net without violating someone else, but still playing a really great game of tennis. A friend recounted a conversation that marked the beginning of the end of her marriage, during which she told her husband, "You misinterpret me completely, consistently. I wear one face, and you have given me another that is dark, malevolent. You ascribe to me thoughts, feelings, motives that are not mine. You miss me entirely." The fundamental outcome of most communication is misunderstanding. We all just attended the same different meeting or participated in the same different conversation. No matter what a person says, we decide in the privacy of our minds what he or she really means by it, and then operate as if our interpretation is true, without checking it out. He said this, you heard that. You intended one thing, however the recipient of your message gave your words a meaning you did not intend. How many times have you said, "I wish we had tape-recorded our conversation, because it would prove that I never said, or that I did say..." Both are convinced their interpretation is the right one. Joseph Pine suggests the experience of being understood versus interpreted is so compelling you can charge admission. There is a universal longing to be known, to be understood. Unfortunately, the experience is rare. Remember, all conversations are with myself, and sometimes they involve other people. This is true in the sense that each of us unconsciously, automatically, puts our own interpretation or spin on the words of others. We are all constantly interpreting everything we hear others say, and constantly being interpreted in turn. If your conversations with a particular individual are always negative, is it possible that you hold a belief that guarantees your negative interpretation of and response to everything this person says? During fierce conversations, people don't cling to their positions as the undeniable truth. Instead, they consider their views as hypotheses to be explored and tested against others. You may feel awkward as you begin to experiment with your left-hand column, offering your private thoughts to others for their consideration. We often speak of feeling our way. To let your feeling lead you is not a bad tactic during a conversation. Here's how I felt my way during my conversations with my client, Philip. Philip and I had met monthly for a year, usually on Monday mornings. Philip is sociable, shares my macabre sense of humor, laughs easily, and is wonderfully candid concerning his shortcomings as a leader. During the second year of our relationship, I couldn't help noticing the increasingly visible veins in Philip's nose and cheeks. He often looked sleep-deprived, his eyes red-rimmed and puffy. Occasionally, I ventured a comment, "You look a little ragged this morning." "Yeah, party last night," he'd reply. "Got to bed around 2. Great time." And so it went. In subsequent meetings, I became more and more distracted by my concerns over Philip's appearance. It was difficult for me to pay attention to his comments about the issues in his company when I found myself wondering if he was becoming an alcoholic. I was stuck. Should I bring it up? How could I bring it up? How do you ask someone, "Do you have a drinking problem?" That's not the kind of thing one brings up out of the blue. Or is it? And who am I to venture a guess? I don't know beans about alcoholism. And sotto voce, my left-hand column asked, "Susan, what are you pretending not to know?" As I got into my car following another session with Philip, I sat for a moment confronted by my cowardice. I had this conversation with myself. You say you care for this person. Do you really? If he is an alcoholic, it's not only affecting his health, it's affecting his marriage and his ability to be the great leader he aspires to be. You've got to say something. You've got to ask him about this. I resolved to share my concern when it seemed appropriate. I didn't have to wait long. As soon as I walked into Philip's office for our next meeting, I knew it would be impossible to concentrate on anything he had to say. He looked decidedly hungover. "Bad night?" I asked. "What? Oh, yeah. I got together with some friends this weekend." The moment of truth. I screwed my courage to the sticking place. "Philip, it's going to be difficult for me to focus on business issues today unless I share with you a growing concern of mine." Philip paused, smiling quizzically. "Okay, shoot." "It's not that easy," I responded. "I'm worried that you'll be put off by what I want to ask you, so I want you to know that I'm prepared to be dead wrong about this." Philip's smile faded. "It's this, Philip. We always meet on Monday mornings after the weekend, and, well, frankly, you usually look like hell." Philip frowned. I took a deep breath and continued. "A couple of times I've asked you about it, and you tell me about another party with your friends, staying up late. You always laugh it off." By this time, neither of us was eager to hear the next words I would speak out loud. The brief silence between us was hard at work, and my heart was in my throat. I spoke as gently as I knew how. "I may be way off base, and I know you'll tell me if I am. It's just that I find myself wondering if the way you look on Monday mornings is about more than good times with your friends. I worry that perhaps you have a drinking problem, that perhaps you are an alcoholic." Philip had lost his sleepy look. His face flushed. He snorted. "I can't believe it. I tell you about my friends, a few parties, and you take it to this?" I barely resisted the impulse to apologize, withdraw my observation, discount my concern. Instead, I waited. Philip pushed his chair away from his desk. I could virtually hear the tension in the room. Philip's words were measured. His jaw clenched. He looked me squarely in the face and said, "One, I do not have a drinking problem. Two, I will never mention my friends and our parties again." He took a long breath. "Now, can we get on with our meeting? I have some things I want to run by you." Again, I fought off the impulse to apologize and instead said, "Yes, okay, let's move on." At a meeting with Philip 6 months later, I began with the first question from Mineral Rights. "What is the most important thing you and I should be talking about today?" Philip sat quietly a moment, then said, "My drinking problem." A careful conversation is a failed conversation. When we enter the conversation with a goal of being poised, clever, instructive, we are inhibited, and all possibilities of intimacy are held at bay. If we approach a conversation with the assumption that we know where it is going and what we need to say, we assume that logic is running the show. Things are not that simple. A fierce conversation is more original and varied in its choices. The heart, the guardian of intuition with its unsettling intentions, is the boss. Its commands are ours to obey. At least, they are mine to obey. Obeying our instincts and offering them up to a colleague or loved one allow both of us to know things we could not know otherwise. Together we begin to see what this conversation wants to be about and where it wants to go and how to make it pulsingly real. One disclosure, one offering from our left-hand column at a time. The function of our left-hand column is intensely personal and surprisingly revelatory. There are differences of opinion about what is appropriate territory for conversations, given one's area of expertise. I am not a trained therapist, so when I encounter things that are beyond my ken, I refer people to a professional. However, none of us needs a license to be a fellow human being or a friend. We don't need a degree to be present. It was not my intent or goal to advise Philip. That's not my job. If I thought it was, I would be in trouble. My job is to take my expert hat off, leave it out in the hall, and come into the conversation and just be available. We all know how easy it is to get into hot conversational water when we shoot from the hip and say whatever comes to mind. It's a very different experience to obey our instincts after having gained skill and practice in interrogating reality, in showing up authentically, in giving others the purity of our attention, and in confronting issues with courage and compassion. Since the conversation is the relationship, there is now a broad and rich context in which to offer our thoughts for others' consideration. And what if your instincts occasionally miss the target? Consider this possibility. Your confusion is an asset. In fact, your search for clarity may blaze a path for others. In working to express what you do not understand but long to understand, you invite the kind of conversations for which others are searching. If you begin to wonder what others will think of you, you won't be able to pursue original avenues. Look for the deepest issue that engages or troubles you. Familiarity with the unknown and with the fluidity of the world is essential. Don't swerve away from it. Speak your way toward it. So, here's your assignment. During your conversations today, pay fierce attention to what you are thinking and feeling. Notice what interests you that is not being addressed. Notice the questions you'd like to ask. Notice the observations your inner voice is urging you to share. Remember that what you are thinking and feeling is not right or wrong. Your thoughts are simply your thoughts. From time to time, choose one to bring into the public conversation. Invite your partner to explore it with you. In doing so, you give the conversation an opportunity to go deeper. Be courageous in your conversations today.
Principle 6. Take responsibility for your emotional wake.
For a leader, there is no trivial comment. Something you might not even remember saying may have had a devastating impact on someone looking to you for guidance and approval. By the same token, something you said years ago may have encouraged and inspired someone who is grateful to you to this day. Everything each of us says leaves an emotional wake, positive or negative. Our individual wakes are larger than we know. Emotional wake is what you remember after I'm gone, what you feel, the aftermath, aftertaste, or afterglow. One of my friends frequently struggles to resolve fights with her husband. She never remembers what he says, just how she feels when he says it. Later, he is angry at her withdrawal, saying, "This is stupid. I didn't say anything worth barricading yourself in here all day." "Yes, you did," she thinks, "but I can't tell you what it was. I just know that I got the message. What you said, how you said it, tone of voice, sarcasm, I think it was, the look on your face, the long-suffering husband, your back was half-turned to me, dismissal." She feels this in her bones. Angry words crouch behind her teeth, ready and willing. He sees the flash in her eyes and knows to stop, then pretends later that this is silly. He thinks, "Silly woman, upset for no reason." "He says I'm his tuning fork," she told me, "his image of grounded, intelligent energy. He values my intelligence, but he doesn't reach for me, doesn't touch me." When she tried to say these words to her husband, her fear and anger triggered both of them, and they added another topic to their list of undiscussables. This marriage failed, slowly, surely. What was needed was a series of fierce conversations during which each of them took responsibility for his and her emotional wake. A friend of mine describes his home at the foot of San Diego Bay, where all of the houses have docks. The speed limit in the bay is 5 knots. Once in a while, some cowboy rips through the area and rocks all of the boats, knocking them up against the docks. The person might not have done this on purpose. Perhaps he was just doing his own thing. However, if a boater is thoughtless and causes damage, he is responsible for it. The water cops will make sure he pays for any damage caused by his wake. Yes, the other boats should have bumpers. Still, each boater is required to take responsibility for his own wake. The question is not, can he boat in those waters? Of course he can. The question is, at what speed? There was a period in my life in which I was unconscious of my speed and of the wake I was leaving during my conversations with others. If this is true for you as well, you can appreciate how challenging it is to live up to the vow of becoming more conscious of the effect of our words on others. In the face of this task, some people decide not to say anything at all to certain sensitive types. Or some decide just to let the chips fall where they may, feeling that if I'm too strong for some people, that's their problem. In the end, the problem belongs to both parties. However, since you and I have little control over how others will react, the most effective position to take is to focus on our own actions. We can say to ourselves, "This is my problem. From this day forward, I will take responsibility for my emotional wake." A negative emotional wake is not caused exclusively by thoughtless or unkind comments. It is created at times by a lack of appreciative comments. For example, my meetings with clients always end with the question, "Given everything we've talked about, what's at the top of your to-do list for the next 30 days? I follow up on that at the next meeting. During a meeting with a client whose long and impressive history of successes was legendary, I got so caught up in the topic for the meeting that I forgot to ask him about his to-do list for the preceding 30 days. I began to wrap up the meeting, and he could see I was about to leave. He said, "Hey, wait a minute. Aren't you going to ask me what I got done in the last 30 days? I want to brag." I had forgotten that people at all levels in the corporate world, even those at the very top, deserve to be recognized for their good qualities and accomplishments. Who deserves your praise? Who needs to know you care? Who needs to be told that you love them?